Hi, everyone, and welcome to Remaking Tomorrow, a series of conversations about the future of teaching and learning. I'm Greg Baer, co-author with Ryan Rudzeski of When You Wonder, You're Learning, Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids. And I regularly get to spend this pod with you. And today, I'm joined by a very special co-host, Sunanna Chand. Sunanna, welcome to the pod. Tell everyone about yourself.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg. I could not be more excited to join you as a guest co-host on the pod today. My name is Sunanna Chand. I am honored currently to lead Teach for America's Future of Learning Research and Development Engine, the Reinvention Lab. And I am also honored to be formerly of Remake Learning and the Remake Learning Network and still have a great affection and love for Remake Learning and everything happening in Pittsburgh.
And Sunanna, you know that this is a podcast powered by Remake Learning, a network that ignites engaging and relevant learning in support of young people navigating rapid social and technological change.
On today's episode, we're talking with Jal Mehta, professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Jal is a leading scholar on professionalizing and modernizing education to foster passion and purpose for students and their caring adults. He's also the author with Sarah Fine of In Search of Deeper Learning, Inside the Effort to Remake the American High School, which I strongly recommend anyone out here listening picking up a copy of if you haven't already. Jal, welcome to Remaking Tomorrow.
Great to be here.
Jal, you in so many ways are a Renaissance human being. You're a professor, you're an educational researcher, you're also a podcast host and an award-winning author. So help us make sense of who you are. Who is Jal?
Yeah, I mean, I think my work kind of works in a cycle. So I'm not one of those researchers who sits in their offices on their laptops running data. I tried that the first couple of years of graduate school, and it's great for a lot of people, but it was pretty miserable for me. And so most of my best ideas come from seeing what innovative schools are doing in action. So I spend a lot of time out in the world seeing what's happening. And then I try to distill that into some common principles and ideas. And then I write it down, I teach it, I podcast it. And then through the courses of those conversations, you know, new questions arise. And that kind of directs me where to look next.
So in Search of Deeper Learning, the quest to remake the American high school, you spent a lot of time kind of in public schools, as you describe, thinking about the American high school. Why did you and Sarah Fine focus there on the high school experience in that book?
I think originally we went into the focus on high schools because adolescents are at this crux where they have the ability to do really spectacular things, and they're looking for opportunities to be treated more as adults, as responsible human beings. And the more we infantilize them in those phases, the less well it goes. Probably our mutual friend Ron Berger likes to say, why do you need a hall pass to go to the bathroom during the week, but on the weekend we'll let you babysit our children? Literally our most prized possessions we turn over to 14 and 15 year olds with no direction or oversight. And yet when they're in school, we have this kind of micromanaging approach. So I'm just really interested in adolescence as a period. And I think we all know that high schools are sort of, it's the part of the institution, the K-12 institution, that works the least well. The skills of students are most diverse. Their interests are most diverse. They've already been in school for a long time. And so what they're hoping for is greater than when they start. And so this is probably the institution that most needs to be reimagined.
Jal, this is a very personal topic for me. I've got a middle schooler and a high schooler at home.
Me too.
Fantastic, right? These are amazing years. And you and I and a lot of our listeners are probably looking out not only for our own kids, but their friend groups and otherwise kids in the neighborhood and kids in our care. And we don't want them to be the ones who check out. Why is it that so many kids are checking out of these experiences that are so critical in their trajectory?
I can answer that, but you just started by saying you had a middle schooler and a high schooler. Why do you think that is?
Well, happily, my kids love school. They've found things that they're passionate about, both in and out of school. And they honestly have teachers who love them. And we say that expressed in so many ways, whether it's a note home or an email exchange, seeing the teachers in the community. So honestly, I feel like my kids are incredibly lucky. They have not checked out, and they have found friend groups that, yeah, of course, they have complaints about school or things that are happening or things that they wished were happening. But for the most part, these are kids, they're on the lucky end of the spectrum among American high schools.
It's good to hear. You know, the National Student Gallup poll polls almost 1 million kids about their feelings of engagement with school. And fifth grade, about 75%, when you build this sort of composite metric, are engaged in school. And by 11th grade, it's down to 32%. So there's pretty much a straight decline across those years. And so, you know, I think the reasons are pretty obvious, you know, that most schoolwork most of the time doesn't engage students' passion or purposes. They at best see it as a mechanism for a longer term goal than they have. And at worst, they're totally checked out. Those same kids are very passionately engaged on the soccer field, in the dance studio, with their friends when they're running extracurriculars. And as you say, with some teachers who create kind of pockets of intellectual vitality and curiosity, I don't really blame the teachers. One of the things Sarah and I said was high school often felt like a play that neither the students nor the teachers wanted to be taking part in. So the students' parents wanted them to do well for college, and the teachers wanted to engage the students, but they were limited by the curriculum, the pacing guides, the state tests, the APs, and the expectations of the students that they needed to get A's on everything. And all of that got in the way of teachers sort of trying to do more intellectually vital work.
This kind of leads into a question that was at the crux of why this book spoke to me so deeply. And you know, I work at an organization, Teach for America, and I'm a Teach for America alum. So how I was trained in teaching was really about the necessity of academic rigor, that young people, particularly young people situated in poverty, deserve the highest expectations around academic rigor and the highest from us as teachers around academic rigor. There was something about that that didn't sit right with me, even as a teacher, you know, 15 years ago. Not that that didn't sit right with me, but that was where we stopped the conversation, that there wasn't these larger conversations about what you call intellectual vitality or passion and purpose or these other outcomes that are harder to measure, but that seemed incredibly vital. And I started to imagine mastery, identity, and creativity as dials. And that Dewey High kind of turned up the dial on creativity and in some ways turned down the dial on the other two. You mentioned Big Picture Learning Network as without a pseudonym, and you said, you know, that turns up the dial really high on identity. And then you talk about the No Excuses School, which turned up the dial really high on mastery. And I'm curious if the dial representation speaks to you or if you think I'm wrong in my interpretation of the book, because in my interpretation, I would say if you turn a dial up to 11, you're consequently turning the other dials down. And if you just do each one at 33 1/3%, you're watering down the whole thing. You have to make a strong kind of visionary choice about what you want in your school. How you would kind of be in conversation with me about the concepts in your book and if that dial metaphor speaks to you or if you would change it in any way?
Great questions. One of the things we tried to argue in the book, and as we've talked about the book, is that when you develop a really significant skill in life, generally it brings all three parts of those three qualities together. Let's take singing, for example. Like you start when you're little, maybe you sing at church or maybe you sing to the radio or something. So there's some sort of spark, like you're starting to feel yourself as someone who likes to sing. And then maybe you sing in a choir or you're part of some sort of group and you start to learn some things and so your mastery goes up a little bit. And then, you know, over time, like maybe you perform in a talent show or something. And so, yes, you're singing a song that somebody else wrote, but, you know, you're giving it your own twist. And then maybe the talent show doesn't go that well. And you realize like, oh, things that I thought I'd mastered, I haven't really mastered. And so then you go back from some more practice or some more lessons. And that process could continue until, you know, you were a professional singer, an amateur singer. Even if you were a professional singer, you might discover, you know, different genres, or you get tired of doing something one way and you move it another way. So I kind of think creativity is kind of the height of mastery, that if you watch like Messi on the soccer field or something like that, like you can make something that is so good that other people haven't seen it before. And so if we're talking about little people, like they're not going to make something that's so good that no one's ever seen it before, but they could make the best version for them at that stage of their development.
Hearing Jal's response, do you rethink your metaphor?
I had two metaphors in my head as I was reading. One was the dial metaphor, which was more of at the level of system. You might design more for one of those things than the other. And it seemed like because of the way our school's systems are designed, you would have to choose. Whereas in an individual learning experience, like the one you just described, Jal, I was imagining more of a triple helix where these things are weaving together and actually each one of them is as necessary as the other in order to accomplish the highest level of Bloom's taxonomy in any one specific instance. And so in my mind, I was kind of separating what makes a really great individualized learning experience for a young person and what we mostly as adults construct as systems around those young people and if we have to make either or choices as we construct those systems.
This is Greg Baer. I'm here with special co-host Sunanna Chan, and we're talking with Jal Mehta, professor of education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, among many other things. Jal, I'm so curious because you work with lots of educators. You've done so through the Deeper Learning Dozen and also just things that you do regularly. You described that when I asked you about who is Jal. And I suspect there's all sorts of wisdom that you've learned from educators and administrators with whom you've met. And probably anyone listening could think through some of those things right now about those relevant learning experiences, about connections and loving environments. What's some unexpected wisdom that you've come across along the way that maybe should give us all some pause as we think about creating great learning experiences for young people?
I mean, I think when I started, I underestimated the way the relationship between the climate for adults and the climate for children. You know, when we went to places where it seemed like the principal was trying to control the teachers were trying to control the students. And when we went to places where the principal was treating the adults with respect and there was some humor and play and enjoyment of the work amongst the adults, you would often see the same things among the students. You know, once I figured that out, I started asking questions to school leaders about how they thought about those things. Lisa Wang, who runs Genesee School in Rochester, New York, I said, like, well, what's the key? And she said, mandated fun. And I said, what do you mean by that? And she was like, well, we need teachers to be talking to each other about student work. And that feels very vulnerable because student work is a reflection of teacher work. And so for teachers to talk to each other like that, we need trust. And to build trust, we need mandated fun. And so like her idea of fun was like discussing student work with protocols. She was just wired that way, but she would take people, you know, bowling and all that sort of stuff. And you can just hear it in the words, like mandated fun. Like there's sort of like a joke in the process. Like she was acknowledging that she didn't actually really enjoy these things, but she would do them because like people in the groups wanted to do them. But what she actually wanted was students doing really interesting high-level tasks. And to do that, she needed to build trust among the faculty. And to do that, she needed to. So I think that was on the list of unexpecteds that like some people really have the whole game figured out.
If you aspire for some type of learning for young people, you as adults need to practice that type of learning. And it seems so obvious in so many ways. And yet we do it so infrequently as the caring adults who are thinking about young people. Another part of your book that kind of stopped me in my tracks was you talking about very plainly the lack of demand that there is within the public for deeper learning. And you wrote this book in 2019, is that correct?
Yep. It was published in 2019. We wrote it a little in the years before that, yeah.
I am curious if you think that's changed at all over the last 6 years. Do you think there's more demand today than there was when this book was published for this type of learning? And why or why not?
There has been an increase in homeschooling, which had been increasing already and has continued to increase after the pandemic. There were briefly rise in kind of pod schools during the pandemic. And I think in general, just sort of this idea that school is an institutional space and that it may not be serving your child that well. If your child is introverted, bullied, a student of color who's not having a good racial experience at school. And so I think there's just sort of increasing realization that it doesn't have to be this way. And I think parents saw some of that when their kids were at home. So that's the sort of like the yes. The no would be external events are not going to save us. Most parents just wanted to get their kids back into school and out of their houses. In my pretty well-educated community, we did a lot of virtual school, and I was surprised that other parents weren't kind of watching what was going on and thinking, wow, my kid could be doing so much more. I talked to other parents who weren't in education, and what I was seeing was not what they were seeing. They were just seeing, oh, it's school. It was school at school. Now it's school at home. So I think that means it's all those cliches, like we are the people we've been waiting for. Like we need to make an active case for what school can be at its best. And I think if people had more understanding of the difference between the education that is possible and that some students receive and the education that most students receive most of the time, there would be more momentum for change.
I love this thing you just said about external events are not going to save us, because obviously we are also in such a moment where you can't escape an education conversation without the letters AI entering into it. And I think some people make the assumption that that is inevitably going to create more deeper learning experiences. And I think what you're saying is there's a lot more, again, a lot more work for adults to do in the system to be able to make that inherently true. So I appreciate that. So you and a group of colleagues are working on your next book, Design Meets the Real World, Improvement, Inquiry, and Innovation in the Public Schools. Can you give us a sneak peek into what sorts of insights we can look forward to reading about in this next book?
Sure. This is a book about people who are using various methods to try to improve their schools. You know, if what's happening in the big picture is the Common Core or DEI or sort of these big policy things, these are kind of the methods that people are using, like instructional rounds or design thinking, to try to improve their schools from within. So we did a study that was sort of like, these methods have gone viral and lots of people are using them. And sometimes they work, but often they don't. And so we start with the story of Chicago using methods to improve their graduation rates and kind of building a system, as probably a lot of your listeners know, around ninth grade on track. And we sort of say that spawns like 10,000 how-to books of like how to use data and inquiry to improve your school or your school system. But in most cases, it didn't go like this. And we try to understand why. Our triumvirate for that book is mindsets, routines, and practices. And so we found some places that put together this cycle of mindsets, routines, and practices. And we found some places that were leading with mindsets, but didn't follow through because the routines weren't there. We found some places leading with routines that was sort of death by routines because they hadn't inspired the mindsets. And we found some places that kind of brought them all together.
Some roads lead to doom and gloom, and others lead to glimmers of hope.
That's it.
Zhao, it feels like we should close this podcast with some mandated fun. So we've got a lightning round of personal questions. Here's the first one. When you think back on your own educational journey, who is a teacher who inspired deep and meaningful learning for you?
I was blessed to have a lot of good teachers along the way. I had a very good teacher in high school, a civil liberties teacher, who saw his purpose in life as to say the opposite of whatever it is that you were saying. So, like, let's say we were like talking about the environment, and you would say, you know, I support X or Y regulation that would support the environment. He would say, you know, what are you, like a tree hugger? Do you want to like put people out of work? Are you a classist? Are you an elitist? Like, what are you saying? And then you'd be like, no, like I want to support the logger. And he'd be like, what are we, is the planet going to go extinct? Are you in favor of that? Like what are you? And so it was just, it was a little sophomoric in retrospect, but it was great to have somebody kind of take your opinion seriously and push them in different directions.
Zhao, it's fair to say that you know something about Harvard, having been an undergraduate student there. then a graduate student, and now a professor. So what's one thing about this very famous American learning environment that many of us may not know?
I don't know. When I was going to Harvard as an undergraduate, there was one girl in my class from my high school who was going, and she was really smart and also really refined. She read Chaucer and knew Latin and, you know, it was just sort of your ideal of someone who you would imagine at a learned institution. And then I went there and I made my best friend for life because we found that we were both arguing over the sports section that, you know, got tossed between our doors every morning freshman year. And I realized, oh, this is like any other institution. You know, there are people here with every kind of love and hatred under the sun. So if you're out there and you're thinking of coming and you're thinking like I wouldn't fit, like you could fit. There are people here who are interested in everything.
Jal, before we go, just one more question. What's one thing that parents and educators can do today to make tomorrow a more promising place for every learner?
Ask your kids what they're learning, not what grade they got on it or when it's due. Engage your children in actual conversations about the substance and model for them that that's what you care about.
Sage advice for someone raising a 2-year-old who has many years of asking that question in front of her. Thank you again to Jal Mehta, Professor of Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Remaking Tomorrow is powered by Remake Learning. Learn more at remakelearning.org.